And I think what lies behind this sort of thing is a certain kind of approach to the world that really demands that the facts have got to conform to my ideological expectations. And if not, that's just not a possibility I'm willing to admit. And there's a certain mentality that feels very comfortable just inventing things or stretching the facts as far as you think they will go, and then verbally kind of playing verbal games with that outer edge of factual accuracy. And then you forget the verbal game you were playing, so you end up going further and further afield.
Greg Forster is a Locke scholar and teaches at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. Right there, he is teaching us about ideologically driven history, something that is an integral part of Christian nationalist storytelling.
You know, it's a tragedy, too, because Thomas Nelson never asked us for any documentation to refute Throckmorton, which really is easy. We've started releasing pieces now one at a time, just pointing out how errant he is, how historically errant. And so Thomas Nelson capitulated. But, you know, what I look at is when you look at the left and secular professors and folks like, and by the way, don't let Warren Throckmorton tell you he's a religious conservative. There's a new piece out today showing just how radical he is on religious and biblical issues. He's part of the religious left. And if you look at his blog, his associates with Jim Wallis and with Right Wing Watch and all these groups that are clearly left.
That was David Barton on The Brian Fisher Show in 2012, just a few days after Thomas Nelson pulled The Jefferson Lies from publication. If you haven't listened to episode 3, you really should to get the most out of this one, and probably wouldn't hurt to listen to episodes 1 and 2 as well. When David Barton's historical errors were discovered in The Myth of Separation, that's in the first episode, he went on the offensive. That is also what he did when The Jefferson Lies was pulled from publication. He immediately started to attack Warren Throckmorton and me, although mostly Throckmorton. Instead of focusing on the history, Barton attacked our beliefs and claimed we were left of center ideologically as a defense of his historical claims. Over the next several years, he launched a campaign against Christian colleges and Christian professors, even falsely claiming that half of all Christian kids who attend Christian colleges leave the faith because Christian college professors were trained by godless pagans. Since most of the criticism of his work was then coming from Christian historians and the Christian academia in general, Barton needed to discredit Christian scholars. It was almost as if the only way it made sense to him that he could be attacked was if the real reason was ideological. Again, Greg Forster.
What often lies underneath this is just an unreasonable demand that the world we live in must conform to my ideological expectations. So I feel comfortable asserting that this happened and that this was this way and that this means this, because it must mean that, because my ideology says it has to mean this.
I'm Warren Throckmorton.
And I'm Michael Coulter.
And we wrote Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson. You're listening to the podcast series, Telling Jefferson Lies, a story about how history can be hijacked for ideological and political purposes. Last week, we told the story of how David Barton's best-selling book about Thomas Jefferson was removed from publication in 2012 due to historical errors. Today, we rely on Getting Jefferson Right to address the faulty claims in Barton's book, The Jefferson Lies. This series also tells a broader story about the surge of Christian nationalism and the misuse of history, which often goes along with it. In that context, we examine the consequences of believing myths and failing to get history right. Finally, we will turn our attention to the history of religious pluralism and freedom of conscience in the United States. This is Episode 4, Getting Jefferson Right.
Bars are open down on Rivington Street. No call, no show, no work today. Wondering if this girl can get something to eat. Well, that job just took the breath from him. And the paycheck never sat too tall. Wants to give that girl the best he's got. Cause the world awaits us all.
After Thomas Nelson no longer sold the Jefferson Lies, there was a period of reflection among those who relied on Christian nationalist stories. From August 2012 through the end of 2013, a window opened for Christian leaders to question Barton's accuracy. Some Christian organizations, such as the Colson Center and the Gospel Coalition, posted articles which acknowledged the issues and problems. Others, such as the Family Research Council and Focus on the Family, privately admitted concerns over Barton's historical productions and quietly edited his work on their websites. Even Glenn Beck's Simon & Schuster imprint declined to republish the Jefferson Lies, as Barton had promised. However, this window didn't stay open very long. In a future episode, we will describe how the skepticism of Christian nation storytelling, which came from the fall of the Jefferson Lies, reverted back to a conspiracy of silence. Today, however, we want to demonstrate as much as possible in this format some of the problems which led to Thomas Nelson pulling the book. We should note that this episode is the first of two with this goal. The next episode will focus on the whitewashing of Jefferson's record on slavery and race, Barton's handling of Virginia slave laws, Jefferson's racial views, and his record as an enslaver deserve a whole episode. Let us say at the beginning that we can only scratch the surface. We hope to give you an idea of the types of revisionism which are necessary to support Christian nationalist aims. We also hope to give you a reason to buy our book, Getting Jefferson Right. The scope of the problem is why we wrote it in 2012, and why we brought out a second edition in November of last year. These stories are still being told in the present day. Obviously, we hope this episode generates a desire to learn more. With all that being said, we want to start with Barton's claims surrounding the separation of church and state. Barton tells a variety of stories designed to erode the confidence of the public in the viability of the wall of separation and the value of religious pluralism. In the Jefferson Lies, he said Jefferson signed presidential documents in the year of our Lord Christ, that Jefferson explicitly approved the beginning of church in the capital, and that he signed legislation directing missionary activities to various Indian tribes. None of these are completely true as stated, but each has a reference point in history. As Greg Forster describes in his opening quotes, Barton takes interesting events and makes them into weapons in an ideological war. We go into each of these claims and many more in the book. In this episode, we take long looks into Barton's handling of the Danbury Baptist letter to Jefferson, the Jefferson Bible, and a fable about Jefferson and church attendance.
As we pointed out in the first installment of this series, Barton began his career by saying the letter from Danbury Baptist ministers was written due to rumors that the federal government was going to establish Congregationalism as the national religion. Then Barton claimed, as he does in the Jefferson Lies, that they wrote to Jefferson because they feared the First Amendment might lead to a mistaken belief the federal government could regulate religion. Let's unpack this. Greg Frazier.
I call him the king of ellipses because he can't make his argument without ellipses, without cutting things out. See, he I like to think he doesn't know, rather than that he's choosing to do this, but I'd like to think he doesn't know that it's not intellectually honest to, when you quote something, but when you cut something out, you'd cut out what changes the meaning of what it is. And this is just a regular tactic, or just simply leaving off the last part of something.
First of all, in the Jefferson Lies, Barton fails to provide the entire letter from the Baptists. In fact, he goes out of his way to obscure the real concern of the Danbury ministers. They weren't writing about a national religion rumor, nor were they writing about a fear that the First Amendment would be used against them. In his citation of the Danbury letter, Barton uses an ellipsis to omit some very important words. In the middle of a letter agreeing with Jefferson's views on religion and government, the Danbury Baptists lamented that their state did not allow freedom of religious expression. In the middle of the letter, Barton left something out that would have identified what the Baptists were bothered by. They said, "Our ancient charter, together with the laws made coincident therewith, were adopted as the basis of our government at the time of our revolution. And such had been our laws and usages, and such still are." That's what Barton omitted. Barton only cited a portion that made it sound like they could have been talking about the federal government. However, a review of the entire letter makes it clear that the Danbury Baptists felt they had an ally in Jefferson for religious freedom. Why would Barton leave those words out? Why would he not want to put in the phrase, "our ancient charter"? The phrase only contains 36 words and does not significantly add to the length of the letter. In the Jefferson Lies, Barton then claimed that the Danbury ministers were troubled by the federal Constitution's First Amendment guarantees. Barton wrote, quote, "These ministers were troubled that their religious privileges were being guaranteed by the apparent generosity of government. Many citizens today do not grasp their concern. Why would ministers object to the state guaranteeing their enjoyment of religious privileges? Because, to the far-sighted Danbury Baptists, the mere presence of governmental language protecting their free exercise of religion suggested that it had become a government-granted right, and thus alienable, rather than a God-given one, and hence inalienable. Fearing that the inclusion of such language in governing documents might someday cause the government wrongly to believe that since it had granted the freedom of religious expression, it therefore had the authority to regulate it, the Danbury Baptist had strenuously objected." This may be a little hard to follow, but you can check the show notes for a link to the Danbury letter and Jefferson's reply to it. I encourage you to review it. I do not believe you'll find any objection to the First Amendment, strenuous or otherwise. In fact, Jefferson's support for freedom of religion in statute was a major reason that dissenters, like Baptists and Presbyterians, up and down the new nation supported Jefferson for president. Let me say again for emphasis, the Danbury Baptists were writing to complain about their state laws, their ancient charter. Barton's failure to include this language makes their actions in writing this letter quite confusing. In response to their actual concerns, Jefferson wrote the famous words about the separation of church and state. Quote, "Believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between man and his God, that he owes account to none other for his faith or his worship, that the legitimate powers of government reach actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence that act of the whole American people, which declared that their legislature should, quote, make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, end quote. Thus, building a wall of separation between church and state. Adhering to this expression of the supreme will of the nation in behalf of the rights of conscience, I shall see with sincere satisfaction the progress of those sentiments which tend to restore to man all his natural rights, convinced he has no natural right in opposition to his social duties." End quote. The Danbury Baptists were not afraid of the federal amendment. They wanted the freedoms it promised to come to their state. Jefferson expressed to them that he also wanted the, quote, "progress of those sentiments," end quote, as well. Throughout his career, Barton has maintained that Jefferson wanted to keep the government out of the church, but was fine with incorporating principles of Christianity into the government. However, Jefferson spoke about church and state other than in the Danbury letter. For instance, hear him in this letter dated June 17, 1804, to Henry Fry, quote, "I consider the doctrines of Jesus as delivered by himself to contain the outlines of the sublimest system of morality that has ever been taught, but I hold in the most profound detestation and execration the corruptions of it which have been invented by priestcraft and established by Kingcraft, constituting a conspiracy of church and state against the civil and religious liberties of mankind. Jefferson did not have respect for either side of the church-state divide if their aim was to degrade the civil and or religious liberties of the people. Whether priest or king, if you stood against the civil and religious liberties of the people, Jefferson stood against you. Everybody needs to hear this. There are several other places in the Jefferson Lies where Barton omits someone's words to create a different shade of meaning. I am sure we didn't get them all, but we did include some key examples. On one occasion, he has Madison saying the University of Virginia provided chaplains to students, when in fact they did not. On another, Barton leaves out a whole section of Virginia slave law. We take that up next episode.
Barton likes to talk about the Jefferson Bible and tells a similar story when asked about it. We want to play three of Barton's media appearances on this point. First, in his American Heritage series, he tells Lori and Matt Crouch about the Jefferson Bible.
This little document here is what's called the Jefferson Bible. We call this the Jefferson Bible, and in the last 30 years, people have consistently said this is the scriptures, but Jefferson cut out everything with which he disagreed. Well, if you go to the front of this work, it doesn't have the title Jefferson Bible. And if you use that title to him, he'd probably have punched you out for saying it. The title he gave it is The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth.
Oh, my God.
What he did was he went through and cut out all the red letters of Jesus, pasted them end to end, so he could read the red letters of Jesus without stopping. It's not what he cut out, it's what he put in. But why did he do that? He tells us, and he did this twice. He did it in 1804, he did it again in 1819. He said that he did this to be a missionary tool to help evangelize the Indians. He said, because if we can get them to read the life and teachings of Jesus of Nazareth, it'll change their life. So this was not a work that he turned and cut out everything he disagreed with. It's a work where he took all the words of Jesus and put them there so you could read the words of Jesus nonstop. And he did that as a missionary tool for the Indians.
Then he tells almost the same story to Andrew Womack in 2012.
One of the things that people cite today is they say, oh, the Jefferson Bible. He cut out everything that he disagreed with. And I actually have an original copy of that. That's really cool what he did. But he explained what he did. And for us to say he cut out what he disagreed with, you have to call him a liar because he never said that. He said, I've grown up with the Indians in Virginia. I know them. And I know that if we can get the Indians to read the teachings of Jesus Christ and obey his teachings, that we can move them towards civilization and we won't have to fight them in Indian wars. He said, just a matter of policy, have them read the teachings of Jesus. So he went through the Bible. He cut out all the red letters of Jesus. He pasted that together nonstop in what he called a wee little book. He did that in 1804. He then gave it to a missionary and he says, here, if you'll get this printed and you'll use this as you evangelize the Indians, this is just the teachings of Jesus. And today we say, oh, he cut out everything he disagreed with. No. He said he wanted the teachings of Jesus put out there.
And then more recently, he embellished it to Ben Shapiro.
So if we go back to the 1804 version, he's in the White House, he's president, he takes two Bibles, he cuts out sections in the Bible, pastes them all together. Now, that's the first Jefferson Bible, and he did that largely, he had been given a friend, Peace, a guy named Peace gave him a sermon from a guy in Scotland named Bennett. And the guy in Scotland said, look, if you want to reach America, Native Americans with Christianity, do not give them a Bible. Because if you do, they might read the genealogies. They might read, you know, and that's not what you want. He said, what you need to do is take the teachings of Jesus and give them the teachings of Jesus. Don't give them the whole Bible. And Jefferson, great idea. So what Jefferson cut out was what in Christian terms would be called the red letters of the Bible. So cut out the words of Jesus, pasted them all end to end. If you read that, you find Jesus healing the sick and raising the dead and casting out devils and all the miracles that are there. It's there. And so, okay, what happened to all this supernatural stuff that you said he cut out? Because it's there. And by the way, he did that. He gave that to some missionary friends. He was really close with Native Americans. He was really into wanting to share the Bible with them. And so he gave that to some missionary friends, said, this is much cheaper to print than the whole Bible. These are the teachings of Jesus. And instead of going through four teachings and four gospels, it's got the teaching one time, so you don't read it four times.
From these clips, and taking into account the Jefferson lies, his main claims are, one, Jefferson didn't cut out what he disagreed with, but instead simply cut out all the words of Jesus and pasted them end to end so he read them without stopping. A related claim is that he didn't cut out miraculous elements. And two, he gave chopped up versions to missionaries to evangelize Indians. Before we proceed to give some background on what Jefferson did with the Gospels, that is, the New Testament books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Barton is correct that Jefferson chopped up the Gospels twice, once in 1804, and then again around 1820. It's not clear when the latter edition was completed. The first effort he titled The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted from the account of his life and doctrines, as given by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, being an abridgment of the New Testament for the use of the Indians, unembarrassed with matters of fact or faith beyond the level of their comprehension. The original 1804 extraction has been lost. However, we have a pretty good idea about what he included, because the two Bibles Jefferson used to cut out the verses have survived, along with a listing of the Bible verses Jefferson intended to include. In our book, Getting Jefferson Right, we provide images of that original listing of text so readers can compare Barton's claims to what Jefferson intended to do. Also, the University of Virginia has the English Bibles, which Jefferson used to snip out the passages to include in the first edits. These Bibles have been used in attempts to reconstruct the 1804 version, most comprehensively by historian Dickinson Adams in 1983. Virginia minister Mark Belisles has also done this work and disputes one passage not included by Adams in his reconstruction. Barton is correct that Jefferson did create another edited version of the Gospel after he left the White House. It took Jefferson about a decade and a half to get back to the more ambitious effort he had hoped to do earlier. In this later work, Jefferson edited the Gospels in four languages and lined up the verses so one could read the text in all four languages at once. Jefferson called this version The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, extracted textually from the Gospels' Greek, Latin, French, and English. This version has survived, and you can buy a copy or view it online. See the show notes for a link to it. Let's first take the claim about giving the edited Gospels to the Native Americans. At first glance, this reference to Indians on the title page of the 1804 version is puzzling and seems to support the claim that Jefferson's work was designed for some kind of outreach to Native peoples. Although it is possible that Jefferson entertained this purpose for a brief time, we doubt this for four reasons. First, as we show in detail in Getting Jefferson Right, Jefferson criticized mission work with Native Americans for the purpose of civilizing them. He also believed that training in trades and commerce should precede education and religious instruction. Second, on at least one other occasion, Jefferson used the term Indians to refer to his political opponents. Although Jefferson's exact meaning cannot be known for sure, we can look at Jefferson's other actions and words to get a clue about his perspective. As we show in our book, there is nothing else besides the 1804 title that supports the idea that he intended his edited Gospels for any missionary or civilizing purpose with the Indians. Another reason to think that Jefferson did not intend his work to be shared directly with Native people is that he initially hoped to do the chop job using Greek, Latin, and French versions of the Bible, in addition to English. But time constraints kept him to more modest effort in 1804. As indicated by his own words and his purchase of Bibles in the four languages, Jefferson had planned this multilingual effort by as early as 1805. Surely he did not intend the Indians to master Greek, Latin, French, and English in order to comprehend the moral teachings of Jesus. A fourth reason to believe Jefferson had no abiding intent to share his work with the Indians is that he never did so. Barton claims in the Jefferson Lies and in public appearances that Jefferson's abridgment was, quote, made up of red letters of Jesus' teaching, cut out of the New Testament, and compiled into a short, pithy work to be read by the Indians, end quote. If this claim is true, then why wasn't the book ever shared with Indians or missionaries to Indians? There is no evidence that Jefferson showed his 1804 moral extractions to anyone. As we demonstrate in the book, Jefferson offered to share the work with his friend Benjamin Rush. Rush told Jefferson, however, that he would not agree with Jefferson's work unless it supported the divinity of Christ. After Rush told Jefferson that, Jefferson didn't pursue the matter further. There is no record that Jefferson ever sent his little version of the Gospels to Rush or anyone else. Jefferson surely had the means to have such a work published. Jefferson contributed to many religious causes throughout his life. Certainly, he could afford to get copies made. However, he did not. Now back to the question about the words of Jesus. Barton specifically claimed that Jefferson, quote, cut out all the red letters of Jesus and pasted them from end to end so that he could read the red letters of Jesus without stopping, end quote. He also says that Jefferson, quote, took all the words of Jesus and put them there so you could read the words of Jesus nonstop. In neither version did Jefferson simply arrange all the words of Jesus end to end or nonstop, as Barton claims. In both documents, Jefferson cut out miraculous elements, as well as those portions which pointed to the divinity of Jesus. He said to friends on more than one occasion why he did this. Jefferson wrote to John Adams in 1813 about his 1804 effort at editing the Gospels. The letter was dated October 12, 1813. These sections are long, but we need to give you the context. So here's Jefferson. We must reduce our volume to the simple evangelist. Select, even from them, the very words only of Jesus, paring off the amphibologisms into which they have been led by forgetting often or not understanding what had fallen from him, by giving their own misconceptions of his dicta, and expressing unintelligibly for others what they had not understood themselves. There will be found remaining the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered to man. I performed this operation for my own use by cutting verse by verse out of the printed book and arranging the matter, which is evidently his, and which is easily distinguishable as diamonds in a dunghill. The result is an octavo of 46 pages, pages of pure and unsophisticated doctrines, such as were professed and acted on by the unlettered apostles. So Jefferson included some of the words of Jesus, but not all of them, because some, he asserted, included the disciples' misconceptions of Jesus' dicta. Jefferson here claims that the writers of the Gospels failed to understand what Jesus said and wrote in their version of his words. Those words, as Jefferson understood them, he omitted. It is important to note that he said he made this compilation for his own use and not for missionary work. He said the operation was as easy as taking diamonds from a dunghill. Although he mentioned his distraction to other friends, we will add just one more, a letter dated April 25, 1816, to Dutch clergyman Francis Adrian Vanderkemp. Jefferson wrote, I made for my own satisfaction an extract from the evangelist of the text of his morals, selecting only those whose style and spirit prove them genuine, and his own, and they are as distinguishable from the matter in which they are embedded as diamonds in dunghills. As more precious morsel of ethics was never seen, it was too hastily done. However, being the work of one or two evenings only, while I lived at Washington, overwhelmed with other business, and it is my intention to go over it again at more leisure. This shall be the work of the ensuing winter. I gave it the title, quote, The Philosophy of Jesus Extracted from the Text of the Evangelist. Consistent with his other communications on this subject, he said the extraction was for his own satisfaction, and that he selected genuine diamond text from which they were embedded. That is the dunghill. It is astonishing that David Barton and others would make their claims in the way they do. If you think about it for 5 minutes, it doesn't make any sense that Jefferson would have made a listing of texts to cut out if all he did was include the words of Jesus. Why have a table? If Jesus said it, just cut it out. But as we have seen from Jefferson's own words, he left out many of Jesus' words in the Bible and out of his extraction. When one examines the listing of texts Jefferson intended to include in his edited Gospels, anyone who has even a cursory knowledge of the Gospels should be able to tell quickly that many words of Jesus are missing. For example, John 3:16, perhaps the best known words of Jesus, for God so loved the world, that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life, was not considered a diamond of Jesus' moral teaching. Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus in John chapter 3 about being born again was not diamond, but dunghill instead. John 14:6, Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. It's not a diamond and not included either. Matthew 28:19, go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, was also removed. In fact, there are no post-resurrection words of Jesus, because Jefferson ended his extraction with the end of Matthew 27:60, which reads, "And he rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher and departed." Jefferson cut out the resurrection and the Great Commission. In addition to the passages identified above, there are many other red letters which Jefferson omitted. Jefferson included lengthy passages on moral teachings from Matthew 5 and Luke 12, apparently diamonds, but omitted lengthy sermons of Jesus written down in chapters 14 through 17 of John, apparently dunghill. Most of the words in John chapters 14 through 17 are words of Jesus. Jefferson omitted them. Jefferson may have done so because in these passages, Jesus speaks of himself as deity. For instance, in John chapter 14, verses 1 through 4, Jesus says he is going to prepare a place in heaven and calls God his Father. John chapter 14, 1 through 4, "Do not let your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places. If it were not so, I would not have told you, for I go to prepare a place for you. If I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may also be, and you know the way where I am going." Given that one of Jefferson's motives for his editing efforts was to purify Christianity from the corruptions which he believed filled the Bible, and given that Jefferson left out long passages of the words of Jesus, it is clear that David Barton is misleading his audience when he says Jefferson's book of teachings of Jesus is all the red letters laid out in order. And when one examines what Jefferson left out, what he considered dunghill from which he extracted diamonds, it seems clear that Jefferson believed these passages did not come from Jesus. It also seems clear that Jefferson did remove the bulk of the material in the Gospels which referred to the divinity of Christ and the proofs of it. To be sure, there are disputes about the status of several verses in Jefferson's 1804 version. There are valid reasons to debate them. It is also true that he left out many words of Jesus, and as indicated by his own correspondence, did the deed for his own satisfaction with no interest in publication.
There is much more in Getting Jefferson Right about Barton's handling of the Jefferson Bible. For instance, remember the Ben Shapiro show clip? Barton said Jefferson got the idea to cut up the Gospels from a Scottish preacher, William Bennett. That's not true. Jefferson explained his motives in his letters, and Bennett's sermon is silent about Indians and genealogies. In fact, we challenge Barton to go on his podcast and read the part of the sermon where Bennett says anything about cutting up the Gospels to make an extraction for Indians. Barton often claims he relies on primary sources for his work.
Have you had a lot of pushback from the academic world?
Oh yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, the Jefferson Lies. There's a couple of professors at Messiah College who have written a point by point refutation. But again, rather than going back to original documents, they say, "Well, Barton's wrong here because it's Professor so and so points out, and Barton got it wrong here because it's Doctor so and so points out." And so it's the same thing. They quote from each other rather than going back to originals.
Yeah, that's
and that's why we footnote everything we do back to originals. And in the Jefferson Lives, we've got, like, I don't know, 800 footnotes or something of the sort.
Yeah, yeah.
And they go back to originals. But yeah, there's a lot of pushback in the academic community. They hate this stuff.
Doesn't matter how many PhDs you got after your name. Doesn't matter how credentialed you are. Doesn't matter if you're the Apostle Paul. I don't believe you until I go check it out for myself. And
so
if you do that,
many of your critics would sit there and say, "This is illogical. You're just taking things on faith. You aren't thinking it through." So they're the ones that are actually illogical if they don't go and check up on all of the stuff that you're saying. If they really want to believe that their logic and they're the ones that are open-minded, then go look at the documentation for what you're saying.
One of the things, they won't say that it's illogical. They say that you're wrong because Professor so-and-so says what it, if they don't quote the documents, they quote each other. And so they're in this incestuous little pool of collectivism where they quote each other.
This fits a pattern from his early days. Accuse your accusers of your shortcomings. This next story is a great example. In The Jefferson Lies, Barton relates a familiar Christian nation story that ranks up there with George Washington's cherry tree as verified history. Barton tells the story in various ways, but we will start with how he relates it in the Jefferson Lies book. I am quoting from the 2012 version. Quote, "Why was Jefferson such a faithful participant at the Capitol Church? He once explained to a friend while they were walking to church together. No nation has ever existed or been governed without religion, nor can be. The Christian religion is the best religion that has been given to man, and I, as chief magistrate of this nation, am bound to give it the sanction of my example." End quote. This quote, "No nation has ever existed or been governed without religion, nor can be," cannot be found in any of Jefferson's correspondence, speeches, or the correspondence of anyone who is a contemporary of Jefferson. The Monticello Library fact-checkers have explored all known primary sources for anything close to this quote and found nothing. In fact, it is probably best to let the good folks at Monticello tell the rest of that story. This is from their website. This quotation appears in a handwritten manuscript by the Reverend Ethan Allen. Allen lived from 1796 to 1879. The story was related to Allen by a Mr. Engle, who claimed to have been told the story that Jefferson was walking to church services one Sunday. Here's that story. "With a large red prayer book under his arm, when a friend querying him after their mutual good morning, said, 'Which way are you walking, Mr. Jefferson?' To which he replied, 'To church, sir.' 'You going to church, Mr. J? You do not believe a word of it.' 'Sir,' said Mr. J, 'no nation has ever yet existed or been governed without religion, nor can be. The Christian religion is the best religion that has been given to man, and I, as chief magistrate of this nation, am bound to give it the sanction of my example. Good morning, sir.'" End quote. The story comes to us third hand and has not been confirmed by any references in Jefferson's papers or any known sources. Its authenticity is questionable. So says Monticello. In Getting Jefferson Right, we unpack the background of this tale, which didn't show up in the record until after Jefferson's death. An unknown man with the name of Mr. Engle reportedly told Ethan Allen that some unnamed person told him the story, and then Engle told the story to Allen. Yet Barton reports this story in his book without informing readers that, quote, "the story comes to us third hand," and that's from Monticello's website. Like Washington's assaulted cherry tree and heartfelt confession, this story appears to be a morality tale made up after Jefferson's death to teach a Christian nationalist lesson. However, Barton repeats it like a modern-day Parson Weems, the storyteller and moralist who wrote a popular biography about Washington to teach lessons to children. In his public appearances, the story, fourth hand when it is retold by Barton, can get even more embellished. On Michael Brown's 2016 Line of Fire radio program, Barton changes the story a little more.
"And when asked, 'Why do you attend church at the Capitol?' he said, 'I'm the chief magistrate of this Christian nation, and it's my duty and responsibility to set this example.' And so Reverend Ethan Allen there in D.C., that's who explained that to him. I've got to make sure people see me going to church at the Capitol. My goodness."
Barton adds to the story by having Jefferson say he was the chief magistrate of, quote, "this Christian nation," end quote. Also in Barton's Line of Fire version, Jefferson explained his church-going philosophy to Ethan Allen directly, instead of an unnamed person who then told the mysterious Mr. Engle, who then told the Reverend Ethan Allen sometime after 1823 when Allen came to Washington, D.C. This gets absurd. Ethan Allen was born in 1796 in Massachusetts, By all accounts, he lived his childhood there and didn't come to D.C. until 1823, long after Jefferson had returned to Monticello, and 3 years away from Jefferson's death in 1826. Jefferson was in Washington beginning in 1800 and left after the end of his second term in 1809. We think it's safe to say that Jefferson, while he was president, did not explain anything to Ethan Allen as a child. While this is a little humorous, it also teaches a serious point about sources. Whenever you might be tempted to rely on a second or third-hand source, think about Barton's fourth-hand telling of this story, and Ethan Allen in his magic school bus time-traveling back to sometime during Thomas Jefferson's tenure as president to have a Christian nationalist chat with him on his way to church. As we noted earlier, there are so many more examples we could give. Barton claimed that Jefferson deliberately designed the University of Virginia to be a trans-denominational Christian college, that he introduced the Bible into the Washington, D.C. schools when he was president, and that he funded the first hot press Bible in the U.S. to be distributed to families. We hope it is clear why The Jefferson Lies won the worst history book in print competition in 2012, and why we had so much material for a full-length response in Getting Jefferson Right. And we're not finished. As noted in the beginning, we did not take the issues surrounding slavery in this installment because we wanted to do an entire episode on that. We take up Barton's whitewash of Jefferson's record on race and slavery in the next episode, which is planned for February 21st. Brace yourself. Telling Jefferson Lies is written and produced by Warren Throckmorton. Today's installment was hosted by Warren Throckmorton and Michael Coulter. The podcast is brought to you by the second edition of Getting Jefferson Right, Fact-Checking Claims About Thomas Jefferson by Throckmorton and Coulter. It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or just about anywhere books are sold. For more information, go to gettingjeffersonright.com. The next episode, Whitewash, will post in 2 weeks. In the meantime, I plan a bonus episode for sometime next week. Stay tuned for that. Today's closing song is Ain't It a Shame to Work on Sunday by the Bethel Jubilee Quartet and written by T.H. Wiseman. Telling Jefferson Lies theme song is The World Awaits Us All by Roman Candle. Background music was provided by Roman Candle and Warren Throckmorton. See the show notes for more credits. Please like the podcast and spread the word on social media. Every podcaster says that, but it really does help, and it makes us feel good, too. Thanks for listening.
Ain't it a shame to lie on Sunday? Ain't it a shame?